We're in downtown Denver. We're speaking with Ken Wilber. It's July 2nd, 2003.
I hope so.
Well, at least here it is.
Okay. No, I hope I'm Ken Wilber. I get confused every now and then.
I sure hope you are. We came a long way to see you. And happy to be here. We're here to talk about integral futures. And I wondered if we might kick off by just reflecting a little, really, on the tradition that we're reacting to, in a sense, what I call the American empirical tradition, which, as I see it, was mostly concerned with reading external change in the world out there, getting a handle on it, and then feeling that you had a handle on the future.
Yeah. And by American, you mean sort of Anglo-Saxon, the British-American empiricism, or do you have a particularly nasty version of American pragmatism in mind that I'm going to get, you know, roasted on here?
No, we're not here to roast you, Ken. We're here to say...
What fun is it then? But really, what kind of, do you just...
I think of the American school particularly because numerically it is in the majority.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Rather than schools of philosophy as such.
And we're very loud.
In the field of futures, America is where it came from. America is what it's about.
Okay.
America is the future.
I understand.
It has a very hegemonic feel in the field. Most of the writers came from here. Most of the science fiction writers who wrote about dystopian futures come from here.
Yeah.
And as Leonard Cohen put it in one of his songs, it's the cradle of the best and the worst.
Yeah.
So much of futures has come from the States.
I understand.
And this tradition seemed to really be very confident. I guess it's summarized in John Naisbitt's Megatrends books, which picked up big shifts in the world and said, you can understand these trends, you know where you're going, you can make money, you can really benefit in all sorts of ways. So in a sense, we were reacting against that, and we were saying there's something missing here.
Yeah.
And over a period of years, it became clear, for example, that the developments in the humanities, hermeneutics, critical theory, semiotics, so on and so forth, all had some role to play.
Right.
We weren't quite sure what they were.
Yeah.
Jay Ogilvy wrote this brilliant piece called In Defense of Normative Scenarios, which summarized much of this material. How an intelligent view of futures necessarily brought on board a lot of the understandings of the humanities.
Right.
So I think that helped us get to the stage of what I call critical future studies, which really looked at things as social constructions, saw that there was something else other than what sits in front of our eyes.
Right.
There was some interior domain.
Right.
Of course, that's when the four quadrants came along, and I think the four quadrants made it totally clear to everyone who looked at them that here was the outside world that futures work had been concentrating on. Here suddenly was revealed in some clarity internal ones.
Yeah.
So I think the first thing that happened was that discovering the quadrants in the futures context was a new opportunity to rebalance the field.
Yeah. I hope so. And the reason that I did mention sort of the Anglo-Saxon tradition, even though America is the Anglo-Saxon tradition on steroids and methamphetamine with McDonald's hamburgers for lunch. It's just a frightening thought all around. But as you know, there's the same split in European philosophy. You have so-called continental philosophy. It's always tended to represent the interiors. Hermeneutics, phenomenology, the great idealist traditions all tended to come out of the continent. And in Britain... tended to really pioneer this kind of empiricist approach. And I'm sure there's some deep geopolitical reasons for that. I mean, the British basically want to know, will the boat sink or not, I think is their main philosophical question. And whereas on the continent, it's like, what do those other tribes mean? But whatever it is, there has been a strange split between the interior and the exterior, what I would call the left-hand paths and the right-hand paths. But it's also a split that reappears almost every discipline. There's almost always the positivists who just, with very good intentions usually, want to look at the objective world and try to anchor truth in that so as to take any human prejudice out of the scene or any human bias or unfairness and try to arrive at some sort of truth that can be reproduced and counted on, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a noble tradition, but it does leave out these other entire domains, not just of human reality, but of the cosmos at large. And those have been the philosophers that have, East and West, really pioneered looking at the interior domains. And it's phenomenology, it's hermeneutics, it deals with inner subjectivity. If truth tends to be objective, then the interiors are dealing with goodness and beauty. Not merely as sort of fantasies or wisps without any reality, but it's very real terrain with as much, in its own way, concrete reality as a rock or a tree or a mountain. And so putting these things together, the general sort of integral approach is a radically different way of playing any sort of philosophical game. Because the general way it's played is I pick a methodology and a stance, and I claim it's the best one, and I claim all of y'all, everybody else has got it wrong. And I defend my position to the death for as long as I live. So if I'm an empiricist, then I'm going to defend that against phenomenology and hermeneutics with great gusto until the day I die. And that's just the way the game is played. And if you get a degree in any of these fields, certainly in philosophy, that's what your degree is in, proving why everybody else got it wrong. And integral plays an entirely different game. And it really says no human mind is capable of producing 100% error. And that means everybody has some piece of the truth. And so now you're asking a very, very different question, which is how can all of these people be right? Now that's a different type. Set your mind in a different position. It sets you towards looking at fundamentally different ways to deal with these really crucial issues. And so balance, comprehensiveness, inclusiveness are certainly terms that we would use for integral. And when it really comes down to methodologies, it definitely breaks down into a handful. And you can use the four quadrants to say there are four main methodologies, and we often do that. Say there are four validity claims, and those are for truth, truthfulness, appropriateness, justness, and in the lower right, functional fit. And those, there's a huge tradition, knowledge-based tradition, of how those validity claims can be redeemed, and they can be redeemed because they refer to real realities. On the other hand, if you want to just choose one of those, then not only do you have the task of using that, you have the secondary task of proving that all the others are fundamentally mistaken. And it just doesn't work very well. So we don't like to play that game.
So applying that analysis to futures, just to clarify, the whole lot of things that just were very difficult to pin down beforehand, mm-hmm. You could see that by overlooking the inner world, you overlook the personal and the collective constructions that in many ways shape the external world.
Right.
In the first place.
Right. Well, very much so. And it's one of the things that I believe is important anyway, is that I've noticed when people sort of get into integral thinking, and certainly as I did, that initially it's a little bit hard to hold all of these different truths in mind. There's a tendency to want to say one or the other and kind of slide into that. And it's hard for people to be able to see that there are, by any realistic meaning of the word, there are objective facts that really are objective. And all facts arise within a cultural construction.
Yes.
And they're both true. Now, a lot of people want to say, well, the cultural construction means that it's not really objective facts. No, there really are objective facts. You can't allow yourself to come down on one side or the other of any of these polarities. Because once you do, you're really having a biased, slanted view. So it's hard to kind of hold these things in mind. But the more you do it, the more the integral vision shines forth, I think. And so objective science, you know, the criticism, Thomas Kuhn, well, it's a whole long discussion about that. Thomas Kuhn never really meant that paradigms create facts or generate them, and he clarified his position to the point where he generally now regards as defending a trivial thesis, which is that interpretations can govern the selection of facts. At the same time that all facts arise within social constructions, people want to say, therefore, social construction is primary, and that we're really, really creating the world that we perceive. I think that's lopsided as well. So you have to sort of, if you use the quadrants and use them as a reminder that I'm going to take each of these as having the same weight of given reality, then it acts as an enormous counterbalance to attempting to say either just objective facts are real, or just social constructions are real, or just the interior eye is real, or just the exterior it is real. And there are what we call quadrant absolutisms about. There are people that reduce everything to I. Those that reduce everything to we are social construction. Those who reduce everything to it are positivistic atoms running around in the void. And those who reduce it to systems. Everything gets reduced to systems theory, or it, the lower right quadrant. And I think all of them are, you know, deeply confused. So if you put them all together, though, then the truths that they all bring to the table can be honored.
The very first immediate practical benefit that I saw from the quadrants, apart from beginning to rebalance the domain of futures, was to see how it applied in environmental scanning, which had been mostly concerned with external realities and overlooked the inner realities. By beginning to balance that up, you could start to pay as much attention to the way things were framed up collectively and individually as to the results of them out there in the wide world. So that was a first fruit, if you like, of looking at that in this context.
Well, it's really kind of funny because you can still look at things like megatrends or any of the sort of objective exterior trends that develop. And nobody's really, in a sense, denying that some of those things happen. I mean, it's in a sense the lower right quadrant, and you can trace technological changes and you can do it quantitatively. And most of what, as you say, future studies, American future studies, sort of ham-handed cowboy future studies. We're not saying they're not there. They are there. The problem with the whole megatrends thing is that it appears to be nothing but a scientific analysis, only because it comes in after the fact of human change agents making choices, putting those into play. And then those show up in some of these trends. And then you think that by simply plotting the trends, you can guess tomorrow's trend. But you've left out the fact that put the trend in place to begin with, and that was human agency of the change agent. So you're really coming in after the fact and thinking you're seeing a scientific unfolding of technological trends, when all you're really seeing is a shadow effect of these other factors that are just as important. And until you learn how to read those interior factors and put those into whatever futures you're doing, then you're going to badly, badly miss what's happening tomorrow. And that's why the great future gurus in this country, they come and they go every couple of years, because they sort of come in on the lucky hunch that got them to spot the one trend by ignoring the interiors. And then when the interiors come in and change that trend, out they go. And you just don't see people with much longevity in this field. Although they're very loud when they're there, and they're, you know. So...
Another part of that, though, with megatrends, is that in a futures context, you ask whose interests are represented here.
Very much.
And if you look at the interests behind that whole exercise through several books, the interests were fairly clear. They declared themselves. It was about marketing and
right.
profiteering and doing better. And interestingly, they actually talked about looking at opportunities, but not problems, as if they set the whole problem set aside.
Right.
So this really made it quite clear where they were coming from.
Yeah. Well, it shows their own prejudice and their own sort of angular interest they're involved in that particular game.
So most people who are now learning about futures are learning about it in the context of the four quadrants, and they're inheriting a more balanced model to begin
Great.
With. At the very simplest starting points.
Great.
If we then start moving into integral operating system, of course they get tossed into levels, lines, stages, states, and the rest of it. Which
Much
is,
to their delight.
Which is, at first sight, a bit of a stretch.
Yeah.
But, boy, what a productive one. So much more, again, comes into focus there.
I hope so. Part of what you try to do, of course, with any sort of modeling is you try to choose the least number of things that are really, really important in the hopes that you're going to cover as many bases as possible. Because you can keep multiplying these variables forever. You can come up with, we use quadrants, levels, lines, states, and tides, but you can think of another 20 or 30 or 5,000 things that could be important. You're just hoping that you're providing a simple enough kind of overview that if people at least touch bases with these, that they're going to not leave out some really important things. And so we're never saying that the quadrants, that there are even four quadrants. I mean, I talk about often eight different native perspectives and not just four, for example. And you can actually, if you just go through personal pronouns, you can come up with 16 or 18 kind of thing. But the four quadrants is sort of the smallest number you can use to get a whole lot of really important reminders across. And so we're not saying these are the only things. We're saying at least check in with these, because if you're not including these in your game, whether it's futures or medicine or history or economics, you're leaving out such huge chunks of reality that those chunks are going to come up and whack you upside your head when you're not looking. And that's very embarrassing if you're in the futures game. You know, if you're a physician, it's okay, because you just kill a few people, and that happens all the time anyway. But if you're in futures, it's like, whoops. So you want to really try to take those things into account. And it's just a really healthy reminder.
And it also, for the first time ever, I think, focuses really concentrated attention on the actual nature and the operating systems within the practitioner.
Yes, exactly. And that's very important. It's self-critical in the very best sense, because you're trying to be aware of that and bring that to the table. And that changes everything in a certain sense. Because you have to put yourself on the same line. And one of the great attractions of empiricism or positivism or even systems theory, which is really an objectivistic approach, is that you don't have to get involved. You can pretend to get yourself out of the picture. It's a favorite masculine eugenic game, is to play these third-person knowledge scenarios. Because it just, you don't have to get involved, and you can avoid commitment and relationships. Every man's dream. And if you're really dissociated, you can be a Harvard professor and teach this stuff. But in the real world, you want to take that into account. And nowhere is it more important than in futures. And so what we do with things like levels and lines and states and so on is invite people to examine their own motivations and what they do when they engage the world, when they start to change the world or impact the world or create an artifact or build a house or drive a car or bake a cake. Those, you can track those objective things. Here's a cake, we put it over here, it weighs this much, 10 people bought a cake. But the really interesting factors that have to be brought into account are, well, what's the type of consciousness doing it? What's the level of consciousness? What's the value structure that's holding that? Yeah. None of the economic moves that matter make any sense without intentionality driving them. Yeah. And that means the entire left-hand quadrants, and that means everything that American futures leave out of the picture. It's sort of horrifying.
We had a kind of cognitive line absolution, I think, in futures.
Very much.
Probably other areas too, but if you're really bright, you can get this really right and you can do really well.
Right.
Forgetting all the other lines, not even aware of them.
So right.
Having that in the picture, having those multiple lines, is this constant reminder to look at the rest of the profile.
I think that's exactly right. And the more that you learn to do that in yourself, then the better a historian you become, meaning the better you can look at other people and see what might be motivating them, and the better historian you are, then the better futures studies you are. Because they're part of the same piece of navigating and trying to understand why people act and why they did so in the past and why they're going to project that forward into the future. And what parts of those future, therefore, you can get a glimpse of. Which is not to tie it down or pin it down or say that it's in any way fixed. It's just not. The future's really wide open. But there are cosmic habits that exist. And understanding those helps you guess what tomorrow's state might be like.
Just approaching that issue through the four quadrants, you're looking at different realities, different types of realities that each have their own progression to the future. Very different.
Very much.
In each case.
Very much. And one of the ways that I got started on the recent book that I just finished, which is the follow-up to Sex, Ecology, Spirituality. We just call it Volume 2 because it's the second volume in a horrifying trilogy of, you know, they're just these monstrous American-sized things. I don't know what that is. but Volume 2, the way I got started in it, was looking at the four quadrants and how they inherit the past. And so I was just calling it cosmic karma. It's kind of a way to look at it. And so, I mean, I can run through any of the, there are many, many theories, some of them very, very well-grounded, that apply to these different entities in each of the quadrants. I'll give you one just very, very quick as an example. Rupert Sheldrake talks about morphic resonance and formative causation. And as sort of far out as his view is, he's dealing with issues that every scientist has to confront, which is how does form replicate itself? So he's not far out or mystical in that sense. He's very, very mainstream, and his ideas are very, very legitimate ideas to consider. But even if you don't use his, positivistic science has all these ideas about how atoms stay in existence and molecules stay in existence and the forces that hold them in existence and so on. But we use Rupert Sheldrake because it's fairly graphic representation. And so he uses formative causation as an example. Now, you look at Alfred North Whitehead, who did a really brilliant analysis of moment-to-moment experience, and Whitehead was facing the same thing, which is how has one moment influenced the next, and how is it carried forward? And he came up with a notion of prehension, so that each moment of experience comes to be as a subject, and that is a little bit of awareness, a little bit of prehension, and then as it passes into the past, it becomes an object for the subject of the next moment that then arises, and that's what he called prehension. So that new subject comes into being and it prehends its previous subject, now as object, and adds its own degree of novelty or creativity, injects that into the stream, and in that is that moment's experience, which is then handed to the next. If novelty approaches zero, then the stream approaches causation. It appears causal. There's very little novelty injected into that stream. Now for Whitehead, novelty can approach zero but never actually get to zero. I guess for him, sentience goes all the way down. But he's still looking at a first-person view of how moments pass into the future, whereas Sheldrake is looking at a third-person, exterior view of the same thing. So I sat down and started looking at basically the past, present, and future in each of the quadrants. And again, things aren't really in the quadrants. Every event has four perspectives or dimensions called the quadrants. It's sometimes easier to say something's in the upper right or in the upper left, but there's just an event and it has these four dimensions to it. Technically, that's the more correct view. But all of these dimensions are carried forward when we look at that. They're carried forward with a different perspective. So you can look at these causal or influence change in each of the quadrants. So if you're doing future stuff, that's exactly one of the things that you're going to do. Mm. Is say, how does this event that I find, quote, in this quadrant, going to project itself into the future, and what degree of novelty is going to prevent me from guessing what the future is because the future doesn't know yet.
Some of the things that are being done in the future.
That was simple, wasn't it? That was so complex, and we're supposed to keep this nice and introductory. I didn't even understand what they said. We just have to cut that part out, I think.
Some of the things that have been happening in the futures domain for some time look different in relation to the four quadrants. Visioning fits in one area.
Yeah.
The notion of design forward, thinking through the sustainable and useful evolution of the infrastructure fits in a quadrant.
Yeah.
People's own development, the cultural support that people get, it all separates out into these different sorts of dynamic areas.
Yeah.
I wanted to come back to this issue, something I've pursued for some time, but which after reading your most recent extracts means a great deal more than it did before. I've always claimed that depth knowledge, depth understanding leads to innovative possibilities, leads to seeing things freshly, seeing new things. And so in reading your recent work, I've come to the notion that depth within the practitioner is what helps to evoke the potential and the capacity of the methodologies that futures people use.
Yes.
Do you have any comment on that? And what do you think? Can you say a little bit about what you think depth within the practitioner actually means?
Sure. One of the things that's so interesting is that we talked earlier about there being objective facts versus social construction, so to speak. And as a first statement, that's right. There really are objective facts and there really are social constructions and they always go together. Facts and interpretations always go together. But I think it does get very complicated because in ways that nobody really quite understands, with each new emergent level of evolution or development or unfolding, then new interpretations and new facts are brought forth almost out of nothing, it appears. And so the objective facts are there, but they change with each degree of depth. And that's what's so interesting. So you can actually get a sense of this if you look at the history of ideas or the history of methodologies. And you can't help but be struck by the increase in degrees of freedom that these successively higher or deeper or wider methodologies bring about.
Right.
And I give you just a really simple example from human development using first, second, and third person. The young child in the preoperational stage of development has essentially a first-person perspective. They can't take the role of other, so they really can't take the role of you or thou or third person, him or he or she. And so there's methodologies that come out of that would be a kind of any sort of first-person methodology can come out of those levels of consciousness, so to speak. When you transition into concrete operational, one of the things that happens is you can take the role of other. So now all of a sudden you have a second-person perspective.
Yeah.
And different types of methodologies can start to emerge at that point, including interpretation. Because now you and I are talking, and I'm taking your role, and now I need to know what you're saying, and you need to know what I'm saying. We're interpreting each other in a very conscious way. As formal operational thinking emerges, the adolescent can take a third-person perspective into account. So it's not just I and you, but they, them, it, and so on. So it's not just how I can view this thing or you can view it, but let's bring in a third person.
Third person's here.
Third person's here. Hurry, we need third persons.
Yes,
there they come. This is America. Anything you want, right on demand. Come. Good. With the emergence of third person comes the capacity for empiric analytic science. If you go post-formal stage of cognition, then you get these systematic, then metasystematic, then paradigmatic, and then metaparadigmatic modes of cognition. Now, those are four levels of cognition that have been mapped fairly carefully by Commons and Richards, for example, and they're all post-formal. So what methodologies come out of those? Third, fourth, fifth, and sixth person methodologies. So all of, and different world spaces are emerging because those methodologies bring forth these more complex phenomena. That's another freshman level thought there. So the idea, though, is that depth of consciousness is helps bring forth depth of reality because the quadrants go together. And so on the one hand, it is a kind of construction because construction is cultural construction is a part of every moment. So there is that that's going on. There's an actual construction going on. And there are also facts emerging in that space. And those facts are objective in the sense that they would exist for anybody else in that space who looked at them in a third-person perspective. So increasing depth brings these increasing methodologies, and that's exactly what you're saying, is that it increases the capacity to see these novel connections and these new worlds, actually.
Mm.
And these worlds are simply not available to any individual at earlier cognitive levels. They just don't exist in that world space.
Yes.
And that itself is why people gauging their own degree of depth is so important in terms of doing an integral approach. Because if you don't have a particular type of depth, then you should know about that. Because you're not going to be able to see certain phenomena that you should be able to see in order to make judgments. So at the very least, an integrally informed person knows their strengths and their weaknesses, and they can say, look, in the cognitive line, I see this very well. But my interpersonal line is not very good. And therefore, I'm not going to get very many megatrends that are driven by interpersonal realities, and I'm not going to see them. And I don't want to mention any names, you know, because every American you've ever met. But that's kind of, that's why you want to have this sort of interior sophistication of your own sort of psychograph, if that makes sense. You can't get away from that, because that's the constructivist part, or the construction part of an integral approach. At least one of those quadrants, lower left, is a social construction. That's what it brings to the table.
Mm.
And so you really need to be plugged into that side of it, or you're not going to have a view of all of the factors that are going into tomorrow's world.
I saw this almost in a trivial sense by looking at the conventional use of scenarios, taking social reality, settled, finished, unproblematic, extending things forward, and then seeing the post-conventional use of scenarios,
right,
which threw everything up. Much greater complexity, many
right.
more possibilities, worlds that could be imagined that don't exist, for
yeah.
example.
Very much so.
In a very small way. I
yeah,
think.
Very much so.
An insight which led that.
And of course, it means that 100 years from now, when people have developed more complex and sophisticated cognitive capacities, they'll look back on us the way we look back on Christopher Columbus and the flat world. I mean, that's just how it goes. That's fine. Yeah. But that doesn't excuse us from trying to achieve the greatest depth we can.
Sure.
At this point. There's no excuse not to do that.
Well, one of the things that the integral operating system and integral methodological pluralism leads to is a richer grasp of the reality in which we're embedded.
I hope so.
Which is surely what a futurist needs to do his or her job.
I think so. And one of the things you do, if you look at the quadrants in the recent writing you mentioned, one of the things I've done is complexify just a little bit and say we can take an entity in any of the four quadrants and we can look at it from its own inside or outside. And that gives you eight methodologies. And I think these eight methodologies are really fundamental ones. They sort of cover all the bases, and they include positivism and empiricism. They include phenomenology. They include structuralism, hermeneutics, cultural anthropology, systems theory, autopoietic systems theory. And those are those methodologies. Again, they're not exhaustive. There are others, but those really cover an enormous number of bases, and you can just get an awful lot of work done if you work with those. Now, on the one hand, though, it's kind of a funny statement to make, because almost any discipline, including futures, is going to pick one of those methodologies and condemn the other seven. Now, I don't know why. I mean, what does that make sense? It's like I'm a pioneer, American. And I am going across the desert. I am going to cut off both hands and one foot because I only believe in one methodology. I mean, that just doesn't make any sense to me. But that's exactly what you're trained to do in these things. Mm. And, there are much better ways to do it than that, it strikes me.
Maybe it's a good point to talk a little bit about the calculus of uncomfort.
Yes.
Because as you're speaking, what we're evoking here are huge mind spaces, which are challenges to anyone, let's be honest about that. So when we're dealing with folk that maybe resent these, our attempt to work within these vast mind spaces, sometimes there's a kind of psychic backlash and kind of resentment.
Yeah.
I think you must have experienced that probably more than anyone.
Yeah. I used to think that if you took approach A, B, and C and showed why they were all important, I mean really proved that they were all important, that A and B and C would really love you, they all hate you. Because you've just demonstrated that their approach isn't the only correct one. They just hate you. And so, I don't have a lot of friends. Y'all come over every now and then, but otherwise it's a pretty lonely existence, basically. Part of what happens is, and, all of us do this in our own way. I mean, so we're, our stance towards integral methodological pluralism is the same as somebody's stance, which is we identify with it to a certain extent, and that's what human beings do. And so there's a self-investment in whatever it is that you hold to be true at the moment, or you wouldn't really be invested in it. And so what that does mean, though, is that people that I would consider less than integral, and that's what they would, contend, but they become identified with just one or two of these. That's where their self-investment is. And so they experience that as an attack, and at a death seizure, and they defend by lashing out. And I understand that. Like I say, none of us are free of it. Whatever it is that we're identified with, that's where our life-death battles are going to occur. So I'm not saying I'm free of it. It's just you hope that what you're going to defend is the biggest possible space. You're going to have to fight to the death, make it the biggest, most open space you can to defend, and not something that's really painfully narrow and causes a great deal of human suffering when it's pressed into action.
You have two or three strategies for dealing with this problem.
Whiskey and pills. No, sorry. That's two. Sorry. yes. We're talking about some of the principles that are helpful for integrative theory, like non-exclusion and unfoldment. Edit it out. Okay. And basically their variations, we can talk about them at length or just give kind of an overview. Basically what you're saying, if you adopt the idea that everybody is right, which is sort of one of the principles that I find useful, is that at some point you have to make the difficult decision that everybody can be right, means everybody has some degree of truth, but some people can be, in a sense, more right than others. Their views can be more inclusive. Their views can be more inclusive and more encompassing. And so one of the examples I use is a simple empirical example: atoms, molecules, cells. We're not saying that atoms are wrong or molecules are wrong or cells are wrong, but molecules transcend and include atoms, and cells transcend and include molecules. So there's an enfoldment principle where deeper, wider truths can enfold and embrace lesser or junior truths without making them less true. It's just they're not as adequate as the larger views. And if you're really seriously trying to make room for everybody to have some degree of truth, then sooner or later you come to those kinds of principles of enfoldment and embrace in that sense. And so it allows you to bring everybody to the table, but not everybody gets equal weight. Because if that's the case, there is no way to get all these views together. Yeah, they're simply conflicting. And so those principles are ones that I find useful. And often people will respond to them because they're good natured and they're good intentioned. Because the intention really is to make room for everybody in a way that's coherent.
And you avoid absolutism when you say not to love everyone, but to love as much as you can.
Yes, that's right.
Moving on to the issue of dystopia, a useful framing
concept.
Not that anyone believes in any pure utopia or dystopia these days, thank goodness. It seemed to me, looking ahead, which I've been doing for many years, that the almost inevitable conclusion of many of the heavy trends that we now have in the external world, particularly through technology and environment, do lead to fairly unpleasant, unlivable futures.
Yeah.
The great drawback from that, though, is that perception of that can stimulate, motivate system change in the here and now. We don't have to go there.
Right.
So I quickly want to reassure people that I'm not a gloom and doom futurist.
Yeah.
It's just that I recognize
that
were we to let things passively run the way they're running, it would lead to some version of dystopia or another. When we were talking the other day, you said something about dystopia being a kind of boomeritis issue. Would you like to just open that up again?
We were talking about sort of the people that only have dystopia in dystopia, because the idea there is it was part of the nihilism and sort of deconstruction atmosphere that tends to go with that. But there's a difference between looking at, now the dystopia trends tend to be generated from the predictive, the dystopia trends tend to be predicted from those empirical right-hand quadrant material technological events. That's what we were looking at. We're looking at the rate of global warming, or we're looking at population, or we're looking at DDT in the water supply, that kind of thing. Those are all exterior right-hand events. And we're not saying that you can't look at those trends and see really ugly things if they continue. And that's all very true. But there's a different type of attitude that can be tapped on top of that, which leads to a very deconstruction, nihilism, sort of boomeritis view of things. And that is, in large view, just a projection of the anger and aggression of a lot of the people doing that. And I just don't think it's very sophisticated. And you have to tease apart these interior domains from the exterior trends that can be indeed problematic. And nowhere can you see this more clearly than the point you brought up, which is the very perception of dystopia trends can sometimes lessen those trends. And whatever you think about the limits of growth that the Club of Romans on came out with, a lot of people feel that they so alarmed and alerted the world, maybe over-alarmed, but that certain things were put into motion that stopped some of their predictions from coming true. Now, again, I'm not saying that that's right or wrong, but it is an example of the type of thing that can happen. And so part of the positive utopian aspect of dystopia views that it's done well is to help prevent dystopia.
So George Orwell, writing 1984, gave us a vocabulary
absolutely
to be alert to those things.
Absolutely. And I think I often find those kinds of writers, I prefer them, you know, much, much more to the scientific dystopia writers that are, you know, have an agenda.
But it's interesting, over recent decades, across wide swathes of culture, and I don't just mean the boomers, there's been a predilection for the negative, for the downer,
yeah,
for the dystopia.
Yeah.
And I've actually spoken to a few science fiction writers about this, and what they have said to me is, look, you know, I really tried to write something that was more upbeat, but I thought it was too hard.
Yeah. I think what's happened is, well, there are many, many factors that are leading to problems. And it's not just technology. It's because technology is an artifact, and an artifact just sits there. We're talking about the thing that moves artifacts around are human intentions. And it's those human intentions that cause most of the problems. We have extremely high levels of cognitive development that can produce incredibly difficult and complicated technological tools, tools that tribes, for example, could never, ever produce. But tribes can get their hands on these incredibly sophisticated technological weapons, and then you get Auschwitz. I mean, it just gets horrifying. And Bill Joy is, you know, famous for this now, and he actually, Bill's, I'm very fond of him, he's coming out here in a few weeks. But he's made popular scenarios of nanotechnology and white plague and these sort of runaway biological problems. All of those are feasible. Now, no moral structure at Orange or higher would ever use those, ever, unless it was just radical self-defense. But structures at purple, red, and blue will use them at the drop of a hat. Now, that's where you get into future scenarios that are interesting, because they actually take into account more of the quadrants and more of the realities that are actually going on. So it's not just that we have the existence of these things. It's that we have increasing pockets of world culture that are purple and red, basically warlord type of street gangs that run countries. And under those circumstances, then you have a real mess. And that hasn't really happened before. It hasn't come to light before, because we had sort of really strange sort of Pax Americana Soviet Union, which was that we had two superpowers armed to the teeth that sort of kept all of the warlords around the world in check. So what would happen, of course, is that we'd go, us, America and the Soviet Union, would go into any third world country we could find, and it left the world littered with countries called North and South. North Korea, South Korea, North Vietnam, South Vietnam, North Yemen, South Yemen. So, but that kept the warlords from chewing each other up. When the Soviet Union came apart, this all hell broke loose. And now we're really seeing worldwide global terrorism getting their hands on these kinds of highly evolved technological artifacts and willing to use them. That scenario combined with what just technological industrialization on its own can do without higher checks and balances, and just in terms of pollution, and just in terms of global warming, and just in terms of the North Atlantic conveyor getting ready to quit, which will freeze Europe over in about 2 months. Yes, it's very hard to get happy about all of that. And it's very hard to come up with future scenarios where the world changes without absolute series of catastrophes. It's hard for me to think that the world's going to change these things before the fact. And I'm not a doomsday person. I just think it's going to happen after the fact. I think all sorts of bad things are going to happen. And at that point, you sort of rally around and try to put stuff in place, you know, after half of the continental United States has fallen into the ocean or whatever, these things are going to happen.
That's what I call the dialectic of foresight and experience, which the contradiction seems to be that you need to have these experiences before you see the point of having foresight.
Yeah, very much.
And the two are linked together.
Yeah. And so the almost the only sort of utopian, dystopian view is that you can somehow manage, micromanage these major catastrophes and sort of string them out in kind of a serial way that would jerk the world around towards some sort of more basic sanity. I don't see it happening without a world federation, for example.
No.
You've got to have world cops if you're going to do this. And who's going to cop, you know, police the police? Mm. This is very, very, very tough stuff. On the other hand, the thing that many future scenarios always leave out is, or certainly underplay, I think, is just the capacity for human creativity. Mm. And that's always astonishing. I mean, it's really amazing, actually. And so it's not to get into the, and I'm not talking about the kind of human creativity that the megatrends people talk about.
Yeah.
I mean, it's nothing but great technological sweetness in life. That to me isn't human creativity. That's technological bullshit. That they just actually think that that's what's happened. I think it's deeply confused.
Yeah.
But I'm talking about genuine spiritual creativity that really can come down and make fundamental changes for the better. Because the moment of novelty that higher levels of consciousness can inject into the moment brings that creative solution that stops the past from determining the future.
Yeah.
Whitehead-wise, if you will, that moment of creative novelty that goes into every prehension. And so this ties into your point about depth. The greater the depth, then the more novelty you can inject into the moment, and then the less the future is determined by the past.
Yeah.
That doesn't get us around the warlords and the global terrorists and the nanotechnology and all of that. What it does say is that if we have governance and leaders in positions that they can influence, and if they have a degree of depth, then there's at least some maneuvering room to get out of what looks very much like a straitjacket headed towards a very unpleasant rendezvous with tomorrow.
That may be the very evolutionary forcing ground, as some people put it.
It might be.
To stimulate these developments.
It might be.
Bill Joy talked about instituting a whole series of checks and balances.
Yeah.
I think the nearest you came a couple of years ago when I wrote a piece about this was calling for integral development across the board. But as you've just said, there are no guarantees about how quickly that happens.
Right.
And how effective it is.
Right.
So it seems reasonable to say that for some time to come, we are in considerable danger of the consequences of that mismatch that you were just describing?
I think so. And generally what happens under those circumstances is small pockets of creativity tend to act as seeds for whatever it is that will be on the other side of the catastrophe.
Yes.
And it's one of the strange things about emergence, and catastrophes are emergence too, so many of them are threshold effects. The definition of emergence is you can't guess what that's going to be.
Yeah.
If you could, it's not a real emergent. It's just a sort of a sloppy redoing of you know, what's going on. Real emergence is creative, and creative means surprise. And that's what's so interesting about it. And there are greater and lesser degrees of surprise. But one of the interesting things to me about tomorrow is just how often people usually get it.
Mm.
There are just so many things that nobody ever, 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 ever came close to getting. And for every Jules Verne, you know, there's 2 billion of the rest of us that don't have that kind of thing. And I find that very interesting. So, yeah, I look back on, you know this, you're okay. I mean, you look back on most of the really, really interesting things. And who even had, you know, a hint about some of these things?
Sure.
And so, we just don't know what kind of creative thing is going to come in tomorrow that can go alongside of the disastrous things that are happening. But right now, I think it's going to be a slow lurching progress, if progress is the right word, involving some attempted world governance structures. I don't think nation states can handle it. They're just not what they used to be.
Yeah.
And you know, a third of the world's largest 100 entities are corporations, for example, that kind of thing. Many of the problems facing the world are global, they're not handled by nation states. Monetary policy, international terrorism, global commons, these things are not amenable to government interventions.
Yeah.
So what is going to be, and that's what Bill Joy was talking about, is what kind of checks and balances are going to go into place. Very hard to see this happening without extensive surveillance, invasion of privacy, electronic surveillance. But of course, surveillance of Americans or British or Germans is not what's required. Surveillance of Afghanistan, Iranians, and so on. How do you do that? So they will clamp down on our freedom, though, just because they can.
Well, look at the lines of people queuing up at airports.
Well, you know, we've got a nice little blue meme president doing everything he can to Not to be judgmental or anything.
Some years ago, I went to a weekend workshop, originally designed by a couple of people you may have heard of, Elise Balding.
Oh, sure.
And Warren
Zieger. Kenneth. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And Warren Zieger.
Yeah.
This workshop is called Imaging a World Without Weapons. Mm. And the basic dynamic was to let go of now.
Yeah.
And to move forward into a desired future.
Yeah.
Spend a lot of time and group reinforcement around making that really real.
Right.
So really getting into it. And
yeah.
then stepping back to the seeds of that future in the here and now.
Yeah.
Bearing that dynamic in mind, I've often played with the notion of a wisdom culture in that same sense.
Right.
If you could make a wisdom culture
right.
resonant and real and attractive and not oppressive,
right.
and liberating and growing, and
yeah.
all kinds of attractive things to people,
yeah.
and replace that and say, well, how would things operate if instead
right.
of raw technical power we
right.
had wisdom at the core?
Right.
How would things look then?
Yeah.
Seemed to be a mind experiment at least worth trying.
Here's what I think, and here's how I think that the Elise Foley thing would be updated. That what she was doing was a green mean projection. In other words, a world without weapons. Now, in my opinion, that's green. And the yellow question would be, how do you handle a world using weapons? Because, with wisdom. Because what green presupposes is that all human beings have green values.
Right.
And that if you simply leave them alone, they will be caring and loving and sharing and tender. And that's just not true. It's first of all, very naive psychology, but it's also a typical first-tier value hegemony. Unfortunately, even in a world that was pure turquoise, everybody's born at square one. And that means people will be going through beige to purple to red to blue to orange to green to yellow to turquoise. And all of the waves of development under orange are less than world-centric. So either egocentric or ethnocentric. And they will gladly dash you to hell for their cause. And that means that any world, even a turquoise, is going to have the world cops. You're simply going to have armed individuals preventing others from exercising their red and blue desires. I don't see any way around that. I haven't heard any convincing argument that you could get around that. And so it's a much more difficult game to play. Anybody can say, let's get rid of weapons.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just the easiest thing. We'll all be nice. I don't like weapons. I don't want to carry guns, so let's just get rid of it. Oh, please. What you have, and I'm an American. We all have guns. I mean, I'm told. So very important to our image, I guess. A real future scenario would be how at yellow or turquoise, how can I use weapons with wisdom? And what's going to be the mechanism where I would do that? And how, because you have to basically stop people that will murder happily. And that's generally what purple and red will do. So under those circumstances, it's a cop-out to visualize a world without weapons, in my opinion. And it's a much harder game to play, how would I have a wisdom use of weapons? Since we really can't get around it. Now, that's a very interesting scenario, and I think that's what any world federation is going to have to face. But there's no way that, I mean, if we had a green United Nations and we said, well, now let's all be nice, well, Saddam Hussein's will just come in and take care of that. And no green sensitivity training is going to get Saddam and Hussein and Hussein and all that fun tribe. You know, emoting and sniveling in their Kleenexes as we love and care for each other. It's preposterous to make those assumptions. So I find it very hard because I don't like weapons. But if I'm not part of a wisdom culture using weapons, then I'm part of a culture that will promote Saddam Hussein's. And I find that morally a coward.
Mm.
So I think you really have to step into how to do these things. At least as a scenario. At least as a way to play it out to see if you can handle that kind of thing. Now, if this is wrong, and we get to a world where everybody simply lays down their arms, that's great. I would love to be proven wrong. I see no chance of that. So that's a kind of scenario planning I think would happen. Wisdom cultures are ones that use all of the first-tier tools with a wider, deeper compassion. not gets rid of them, but uses them with a sane boundary and a sane balance and a sane caring and concern. But that doesn't mean you can therefore get rid of the unpleasant realities of some of the lower stages of development. Ethnocentric stages are ethnocentric. And that is simply their nature, and that's not going to change unless they develop forward.
So the notion of a wise culture per se, is that just too hard?
No, but a wise culture uses a culture of the seventh chakra uses all of the tools of the first six. And that means food and power and aggression and sex. It doesn't mean you get rid of them. A lot of people's idea of a wisdom culture is I get to the seventh chakra and then I just go up in life. And there's no first, second, third, fourth. That's not a wisdom culture.
Yes.
That's an ascended, associated.
Okay.
Theravada culture.
Right.
A wisdom culture exercises all of those things across the entire great chain of being. And unfortunately, in some of the lower stages of development, that can't take the role of other extensively, then their own goodness is confined within the limits of their perception. And that usually means within the limits of their tribe or their family or their group or their nation or their clan. And it's very rare that human beings, 70% of the world's population is ethnocentric or lower. And that's much scarier than nanotechnology, if you want to know the truth. I mean, if you actually look on the interior domains and plot some of those things out, that's much scarier than somebody, because they're the ones driving the exteriors. If I looked on the interior and saw nothing but turquoise, I wouldn't worry about nanotechnology.
Right.
It's not a problem.
Because you don't know how to use it.
Yes. They would not use it to harm. It's just not possible for turquoise to use that to harm somebody. And if they are, they're operating from red or lower, by definition, operating from lower levels of morality.
So despite the interlinked nature of what you call tetra-evolution,
right,
nevertheless it does seem that consciousness is primary in these areas.
In a sense, yes, but the way I sort of really fine-tune the thing is that an event arises, and if you look at the event in first-person perspective, you feel consciousness. If you look at the same event in a third-person perspective, you will feel matter. You will feel an exterior. So it's not that sort of there's one and then the other comes. They do arise together. Nonetheless, the thing that we call consciousness has it, what we would call intentionality. So that appears to be where the action comes from. But it's still, they still arise together and arise simultaneously. But in simplified form, yes, consciousness, intentionality is what, quote, drives the exteriors. And so if you, instead of just doing megatrends where you track the exteriors and then try to figure out what they're going to do left to their own devices, which is your implicit assumption, you track interior intentionality to see what's actually driving this. And that's why those megatrends change all the time in ways that these people don't guess.
Yeah.
So as I said, if you look on the interior and you see red and blue driving nanotechnology, then give the world about 10 years and we're going up in smoke. If I look on the interior and see green or yellow or turquoise, that is a different scenario. Now, since human beings span the entire spectrum, the question is, well, who's in charge? Or who has the artifacts and the nanotechnology and all that? And the reason that Bill Joy and others want to come in with something like a world federation of checks and balances is that you have to basically have that kind of managerial governance structure for people at ethnocentric or lower levels of development. So we have to come in and say, look, it's against the law to do this. And then you have to try to police it. There's just no other way to do that. Because the only other way to get people not to use it is to get them all up to turquoise. 0.5% of the world's population is turquoise. That's going to be, it's a long time coming for that one. So
there, in a nutshell, is the civilizational dilemma that we face.
That is?
How long it takes to move down those move up those stages.
And, you know, and in the future it'll be another version. I mean, you know, 1,000 years from now when they're at fifth tier, they'll look back at us like, you know, barbarians that we are. So that part is sort of unending. But right now all the action is just that. It's at those stages of consciousness that are world-centric, that have care and compassion for basically all human beings and even all sentient beings. versus those that just aren't quite up to that. And it's not a bad thing to say they're not up to that. That's the spiral of development as it unfolds. It's just you can't let those elements get a hold of these other elements, because you put the two together and the world goes boom. And so that's why there's almost no other way to do that except the cops. You're just going to have to police this stuff. And I agree with Bill Joy on that. I don't see any other way that we can do it. Now, I don't know if we'll be able to do that, because then that gets on all very ugly things. But fortunately, most of the really difficult nanotechnologies, it's hard to build a lot of those things, mostly. So it's a little bit harder to get your hands on it. When some of them become very accessible, then the world will face some very, very difficult questions. And how we will put a world police force into play is a very, very scary thought. I hope we come up with other options. But it's certainly a very likely scenario, given the interiors, if you bring those into the equation.
We've been talking about dystopia, the varieties of dystopia, but maybe we could finish by thinking a little bit about some of the things that people might want to do constructively to move towards better futures. Do you have any comments on that subject, Ken?
The way I handle that is it's just important that everybody does what they can to increase their own depth just a little bit each day, because you end up leaving the world just a little bit more whole than you found it. And even if that's a micron, I think those microns add up, and I think that when we reach those threshold events, that the more depth there is on this side of the threshold, the happier the outcome is on the other side.
I think you wrote somewhere, better to light a candle than curse the darkness.
That's an old saying, but I adopt it happily. All right, then.
Thank you.
Thank you.